I'm Barry Shelley, and this session is entitled, What is this all about, this liberation theology? I phrase it that way because I think that's very often the way people respond, is hearing liberation theology, the term being batted around and really having no idea what that really means. So hopefully in 1 hour we're going to learn. That will be quite a feat if we actually pull it off. Let me just say again, I don't consider myself one of the world's leading experts on liberation theology. It is something that I've studied both in seminary and probably even more since I left seminary than actually in seminary, and have spent a little bit of time in Central America and also with people. Talking to some people who are doing liberation theology out of Africa as well. What I want to do is give today is really spend the first part of the time talking and presenting information, at least from my perspective, to you, and then trying to make sure we save some time at the end for discussion. And let me also just say that if at any point you have a question of clarification or don't understand something, please raise your hand, or if I don't see you, just simply ask me. I'd like to start by just talking a little bit, just very much in general, about the term liberation theology and the history in Latin America, and then talking in very much in generalities, because that's really the only way you can do that in an hour, about what are the basic themes of liberation theology? What are the characteristics of it? What makes a particular way of thinking liberation theology as opposed to some other kind of theology? And looking at some specific themes out of that. And then hopefully we'll have some time. I have some quotes I want to read, and I hope to get some people involved in reading a transcript of a Bible study that took place in a base Christian community in Nicaragua, which would be a way of doing liberation theology, and maybe that reading that will help us understand, and talk a little bit about what this all means for North Americans, because it does not come out of North America. That's probably the first thing we need to understand. So that's a sort of a brief outline. And I've also just written across the top here some of the key Medellin I'll talk about. That's a city in Colombia, 1968. It was a conference there. I'll talk about that. The rest of these names are the names of people that are particularly important in liberation theology. A few will quote... I have some books that also show too, but when I say a name, I think it always helps me at least to be able to visualize it, to be able to understand what it is. Okay. Let me just say, first of all, that liberation theology is not uniform, is not like one liberation theology. It's not a systematic collection of philosophies or theologies, and in fact to make it such would be to do just the opposite of what liberation theology is all about. Now hopefully by the end of this you'll understand that statement a little bit more. So again, this is really going to be a stab at some general kinds of themes, and please understand all of this in the context of saying that you cannot say that all of these people, Bonino and Gutierrez and Cardinal Freire, well, Freire's really more of an educator, but Segundo and Sobrino, they're not all the same. They're different people writing, and people who are doing this and thinking about it are not all agreeing to everything. So that's the first thing to understand. The second thing is to understand is that I'm going to be talking about liberation theology primarily out of the Latin American context, but that isn't, again, all of liberation theology. Liberation theology is a term that is now it's growing out of Africa and Asia as well. Essentially the third world is what we're talking about. So I think the first thing to understand historically is that 1968, in Medellin, Colombia, there was a conference of Latin American bishops. Obviously, most of Latin America is Catholic, and that's the first place that we really need to begin. It was the first time that significant numbers of Catholic hierarchy really addressed the structural nature of evil. And violence. I think that we tend to think of evil or as racism or those kinds of things. We tend to want to think of those in individual sort of personal things. We don't really want to see things in a structural way. We don't want to see our system as violent or our system as evil. And it's the first time that really happened. It was after the Vatican II that we may know something about in the early 60s, when the Vatican Council met for several years and there were great reforms out of the Catholic Church, and there was a real sense that some different kinds of perspectives were taking place. Well, when this conference took place, what essentially was the outcome of that was what is the term usually used is preferential option for the poor. And essentially they came out saying the church needs to take sides. The church needs to be on the side of the poor. That what is happening in Latin America and the revolution that is brewing here is really a matter of economic injustice, and the church has got to recognize that, and the church has got to get involved in that and not just spiritualize everything. A major paper or statement came out of that conference that really was a major shift in Catholic theology and policy. Now, the practical result of that was that for the first time, large numbers of priests went into the countryside. Before that time, you primarily had the Catholic hierarchy and the priest in the urban areas. And occasionally, maybe priests would make a circuit through the countryside to give communion, you know, maybe once a year or less. Most people in the country, the poor people primarily, did not have churches, did not have access to priests. And of course that meant in the Catholic Church, where the Mass was in Latin and the Bible was primarily read in Latin, people who probably couldn't read their own language anyway, and certainly there was very little sense of empowerment among the laity for leading church services, that sort of thing. That essentially meant that there was very little church life. And there was also very little contact between the Catholic priest and the poor people. Now what happened is that as priests started going into the country, they were completely transformed. They were converted, in a sense, in a way that they had not been before. They started learning, for the first time, what it meant to be poor. And they started identifying with the poor, these priests that have gone out. And even still, I'll say this, in Latin America, you still have a split between the priest, especially in Nicaragua, it's very clear. The priest in the countryside in Nicaragua have very different perspectives on what's happening in Nicaragua as opposed to the bishops who are in their large churches in the cities. Essentially what they realized that the reforms, so-called reforms in those countries, political reforms, economic reforms, simply were not working. They really didn't affect the poor. It was out of that then in 1972, and I won't go into this in very much detail, there was another conference in Santiago, Chile, that was a group of priests primarily that were not the bishops. This was more of the parish priest and the laity who got together again after 3 or 4 years after Medellin, where there had been this kind of influence and this kind of contact. And they essentially came to a point of saying there's really no solution to this problem without revolution. And that does not necessarily mean violent revolution, but what they meant was the church has got to start addressing the needs of the poor in a way that looks at things in a completely systematic way. that we can no longer just sort of plod along and think that our major task is the sort of spiritual conversion of people when people are living in the conditions they are. And they made even a stronger statement, which was not as much sort of accepted Catholic policy as it was a movement. And essentially saying that to live a life of faith cannot be one of sort of abstract theory. It means living it out, and it means to be involved. In Latin America, it means to be involved in struggle for the poor. There is no other way for them, they saw, to live in that situation and to live a life of faith. There is really no neutrality. To be neutral is to be on the side of the forces that oppress the poor. So it's really out of some major kinds of shifts in church policy, primarily that lead to contact with the poor, that the whole sort of gurgling up of liberation theology begins. And it has now developed, essentially you have a situation where some of the educated and the priests are in contact with the poor, and there's some kind of what Paulo Freire calls conscientization, where essentially the educated who have the tools of analysis and can look at stuff and sort of be able to see things in an overall sense unite, have an alliance with the poor who really see reality. Essentially the claim is it's the poor who really see the world in the real terms, the closest to reality. It's not those who are on top. It's the poor who really understand the world in the sense of what's really closest to reality. And when you have converted, educated people in alliance with the poor, that out of that grows this sense of liberation theology. Okay, let's talk a little bit about what liberation theology really is. The starting point of liberation theology is the poor. I've just sort of, this is an outline up here. That it's the poor and the marginalized, and a liberation theologian would say that that is clearly supported by the Bible. That the starting place in the Bible is the poor and the oppressed. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes and read some stuff on that. That it is really in the situation of the poor that God is found. That doesn't mean that God is not found in the lives of people who are wealthy at all, but it does mean that God really is at work with the poor. That is God's partiality. That God is not a God that is impartial and aloof from people and doesn't take sides. That God does take sides. And that God took sides all through the Bible. And that we need to read the Bible in a new way again. Not really what is a new way, but the way that it was originally written. But for us, that's a new way. That the God of the Bible is a God of the poor and a God of the oppressed. Then when we accept that... As I've already said, that the poor view of the world is the closest to what reality is. Now, why would you think, even if you don't agree with that, why would you think somebody would make that claim? I mean, I could even put it in another way. Another statement would be that the poor really understand the gospel better than the rich do. Now, why would it be that the poor could understand reality and the gospel better, in a general sense? Yes.
We have more to look forward to.
Okay, that's...
Rich already.
Well, actually, I think a liberation theologian would say, and I guess I would too, that the poor are with God now.
They're having a tough time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's right.
Is it because they don't have that economic security and they need that they are closer to survival? I mean, their life is one of survival, so they don't trust in the economic security as more affluent people do.
Right. I think that's certainly part of it, is that their trust is not in material things to start with. And I think maybe one way of putting yours would be that that they really understand the need for God's help in a way that the wealthy don't. I mean, that's probably a better way. I didn't mean to respond. So those two. Other things that perhaps...
The wealthy are the people who are favored by the church, because the wealthy are able to contribute more for our fine church buildings,
right,
and literature and everything that we need money to produce.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. And
before, although we love them, they are not able to contribute enough to support our modern-day church programs.
I think, that unfortunately, that's true. And so they're sort of shunted out. Hold on just a second. Somebody had asked me what the question was.
Yeah.
The question was, why would it be that the poor... view of the reality of the world would be closer to what real reality is than, say, the rich? Or another way, and I think they're both related, is why would we might want to make the statement that the poor would understand the gospel in better ways than the rich would?
Well, I would answer the latter, I guess, by the earlier statement that if they feel that the Bible starts with God on the side of the poor, maybe they understand that point because the Bible is for the poor.
Yeah, there's a sense of understanding God's redemption, that God's power is really there, that God really does stand for that, because we're not putting our faith, as she's already said, in material things. And you were going to add...
Oh, I was saying, I grew up in a poor family with 10 children, and we never thought of ourselves as poor. We never felt we were any different than anybody else, so we grew up and knew what life was about. We were happy.
Right.
We had food. I think poor people are happier than people.
Right. Well, but you had food. And that doesn't mean I want to say that you weren't poor. But there's a level of poverty at which people don't have food, and that includes millions of people in this world.
We have days we didn't know where it was coming
from. Right. Right. Yes.
I think that there's many, many different kinds of reality. And that when you have a system of oppressed and oppressor, the people who are oppressed have to know how to live within different realities within the system of the oppressed. The people who are oppressing them, or who are rich, or whatever the case is, do not have to understand the underside of it,
right,
to exist. The people who live at the bottom have to understand how to exist in the rest of the world.
I think that's very well said.
One more thing. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, sure.
I think that a very large reality in all of life is death. People who are poor, who don't have enough to eat, are very close to death throughout their lives.
Okay. Yeah, there's a sense of the security essentially in different places, and or the lack of security, and the recognized need for interdependence, both on other people as well as on God. I'll take two more, and then we'll go on. Yes, sir?
First.
Okay, Bill?
Probably Gutierrez, in his book, We Drink From Our Own Well, describes it as liberation theology in comparison to academic theology, people theology, and the lives of the poor people are so basic that their complete existence is the church and survival.
Right.
And everything involved is around that. That's their whole life. And the wealthier you get, the harder it is to keep your attention to the way of the cross.
Right.
Because we get often because of the materialistic.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And to
one more comment on this one.
Our country has huge surpluses of farm products,
mm-hmm,
that they have to pay money to put into storage. And we are sending munitions over to those countries where they have such a large problems with starvation, And it, I think that our church should stress the importance of sending our surplus food supplies over to those countries to feed those poverty-stricken areas rather than anything else.
Right. Well, I'm sure probably most of us would agree with you in some level on that. If we could wait, and we'll get into, if we have time, we can get into some specific ideas about how we as North Americans might respond at the end, but I think that's certainly part of all that. Just to keep sort of moving down, if you start with the poor, then, and you accept that poverty is a real reality for really, unfortunately, the majority of the people in this world, then the next step is that if you have really, if you are a person of faith, that you cannot really confront that reality without responding in action. And that means political action and liberation theology. And that you sort of conclude at that the world should not be the way it is. I mean, that's really what has to happen out of really, truly confronting what's going on. Not just sort of passing over, but really looking at what's going on. Let me just read... this is from Gutierrez, Gustavo Gutierrez, who was really one of the earliest. In fact, his book, A Theology of Liberation, is probably the first written down book in the whole sort of liberation theology movement. He said, I discovered three things. I discovered that poverty was a destructive thing, something to be fought against and destroyed, not merely something which was the object of our charity. Secondly, I discovered that poverty was not accidental. The fact that these people are poor and not rich is not just a matter of chance, but the result of a structure. Thirdly, I discovered that poor people were a social class. When I discovered that poverty was something to be fought against, that poverty was structural, that poor people were a class and could organize, it became crystal clear that in order to serve the poor, one had to move into political action. Okay, so that's essentially where the liberation theology starts moving, and we'll get back to some of that. So it really does challenge our notion some of God in the world. Theology becomes a response to questions of the poor, of people who are essentially non-persons in our world, more so than it becomes a response to non-believers. Now, I want to stress that, and at the same time, I don't want to overstate it. That in liberation theology, that the major, when you start with the poor, theology becomes something of trying to answer questions responding to the situation of the poor, of the non-persons, than it does responding to the situation of non-believers. That does not mean, I want to qualify that by saying, that does not mean that people in Latin America involved in what they would term liberation theology do not see it as important to evangelize. In fact, they're very evangelical in one sense of that word, that different kinds of conversion are very, very important. But it means that the basis of theology is first and foremost a dealing with the situation of the poor in the world, and that it's almost through that kind of service that conversion takes place to people, to Christianity, to our life of faith. The questions are, how can poor people believe in a God in a society that systematically destroys us? In other words, it's going to be hard to go to poor people and talk to them about our God if we still put it in the terms of a wealthy country. How can a poor person really respond to that? How the poor person is going to ask, how can a God be personal when all conspires to deny that I'm a person? Everything I've experienced in this world, if I am really poor, essentially treats me as though I'm not important. So those are things to think about. I know we could talk a lot about that, unfortunately, for time we won't. And so the questions, I think, for North Americans on that particular aspect become things like, how do we justify a faith that tolerates a situation where millions are non-persons? How do we do that? I think in many ways, the way that we set up our faith, unfortunately, actually makes the situation worse instead of better. How can we remain complacent in light of structures that benefit us at the same time that they destroy others? And again, we have got to start acknowledging the connections. It is not simply that we have a good thing and unfortunately other people don't. There are a lot of ways in which we benefit because other people don't have what they have. I think that we have to start looking at our own national history in ways that we have not in the past. And finally, how can we speak of God when our church and our nation sanction a way of life that expands misery rather than combating it? Again, the same kind of thing. Well, to end up the sort of section on beginning with the poor, I want to read a transcript of a conversation with a woman from Mexico. Her name is Adela Jimenez. And okay, so all of you, this is spoken to a group of North Americans who are, she's part of a base Christian community in community of people in Mexico, and this is spoken to a group of North Americans who are visiting, and this is actually transcript. So all of you are servants of a society. You have come here with an objective, how to be better servants. This has been my goal, to be a better servant of God among God's people, a servant to his people. It is the pain that we see among others that pushes us into change and action. I was from a very poor Campesino family. It is this that led me to the church. One day a man asked me if I knew the book of Genesis. I did not, but I thought, if I say yes, I will lie. If I say no, he will think less of me. I lied. Then he said, you must also know Ecclesiastes. I said I had to go. But these two names stayed in my mind. I had to learn. I asked my husband. He sent me to the priest. The priest said it wasn't necessary for me to know things like this. My husband and I continued looking, though. This is really sort of getting into the whole transition over the last 20 years. A long time ago, as I was going into the cathedral, I saw little pocketbooks on the ground for sale. I saw Genesis, and we bought this and four others. We were hungry. We devoured them. One day we came upon a whole Bible. For 8 years we studied this, just my husband and me. Then we met others and began to study the Bible with them. Later we met Segundo Galilei after Vatican II. He taught us that many church teachings were simply human teachings, not God's. He was with us for 6 days. In other words, there's starting to be a real challenge to all the church sort of policies that really in many ways oppress the poor. Another priest invited us to go on a mission with 10 other couples to tell others what we had learned. Us, missionaries? Us? Dirty us? Ignorant us? What do we know? Yes, you. I still have trouble with some priests because the people speak out for themselves now and are assertive about their needs. The authority of the priest seems unsure. The people are like children, becoming rebellious and asserting themselves. That is what it is like. The priests want people to be quiet and just bring money. When the people wake up, then the priests no longer have power, civil, economic, or religious, over the people. This is what Jesus saw happening. What was going on in the temple? Jesus says, "You have converted the house of prayer into a home of robbers." Jesus said in the last days, every corner of the world would hear the word. That is now. It is happening here. That's the work we do in our communities. And again, that sense of it's happening here is important. It's hard to take all these themes and do them nice and orderly and neatly. They all sort of fit together. So I'm realizing that our time is slipping away, so I better move on real quickly and just try to summarize this stuff. And then another aspect of liberation theology is that it is less philosophy, the method it uses, less philosophy and more social sciences. Now, you know, most of the time in our Western world, we think of theology, what we automatically see it as philosophy. I mean, Thomas Aquinas is certainly a major theologian, and he is bases a lot of what he does on Greek philosophy, and that certainly has been a crucial influence in the study of theology all the way through the years since then, or even there was that too beforehand, but he was the one that really set out the direction. But for a liberation theologian, or just a person who's dealing with these kinds of issues, they're going to say, well, if I really need to understand if I'm going to try to attack poverty, I need to understand the structure and the economics of that society in order to attack it. Philosophy is not going to do me as much good as sociology and economics, political science, psychology, those kinds of things. One of, and I think we have to say, that the key social analysis tool of liberation theology has, to a large degree, for a lot of people, been Marxism. And I want to say something about that. First of all, I'll just relate a little story. When I was in Nicaragua, I had what I considered quite an honor to meet with Fernando Cardenal, Minister of Education in Nicaragua, and is a Jesuit priest. And I asked him a question about the interplay between liberation theology and Marxism, and I won't go into his whole response, but he essentially said, North Americans tend to completely judge us if they hear Marxism in anything we say. He said, judge us by our fruits. He said, isn't that what Jesus said? He said, judge the tree by its fruits. He said, if we're changing a society that helps the poor and gives true freedom to people, judge us by that. He said, I'm not a Marxist. He said, but I do think that Marx has some important things to teach us in his social analysis. Just to start with that, I do want to just say that I think that, again, that we as Westerners have a tendency to hear Marx, and then that's the end of the discussion. That therefore our whole posture from that point on becomes one of, if Marx said it, then we have to refute it. Well, what do we do when Marxist insights become the same as biblical insights? Because there are a lot of things that are the same. Does that mean that if the Bible says it and Marx says it, it's the same thing? That means that we say it's not true because Marx said it. So that's just one thing. I think, and the question then is, how many people really know anything about Marx before we try to refute everything that Marx says? There really isn't any party line, so to speak, in liberation theology on Marx. There's not one way of dealing with Marx. And I guess I just want to suggest three different ways that people can use Marx or deal with Marx. We could add four and say to completely refute Marx. One way, though, would be to use Marxism as a complete worldview, where Marxism really becomes a religion in itself. And if you're doing that, you would accept all the stuff that Marx taught, the sort of inevitability of armed struggle, religion as being an opiate of the people, so the economic determinism that he talks about, all those kinds of things. And Marxism really does become an all-encompassing, really pretty fanatical view. Another way would be to use Marxism as a plan for political action, so to speak, as sort of using Marxist insight as strategy. And the third one would be to use Marxism chiefly as an instrument of social analysis, as a way of trying to better understand the world and how the world works. That is basically what is happening in liberation theology. Most liberation theologians would not say, I am a Marxist in the sense that I am a person who accepts everything that Marx believes. I personally am the same way. I do believe that Marx offers us great insight into understanding how people are oppressed and how economics in the world work. That does not mean that I accept Soviet communism, which really isn't Marxist anyway, start with. I mean, I think we often think of Soviet communism as being what Marx taught, and that really isn't the case. Let me just finish up, Bill, and say, I am in no way a Marxist, but that doesn't mean that Marx does not have insights that we need to learn about. And the other thing I would say is that the reality of the world right now is that millions of people are using Marxist insights to understand this world. And I think it's about time that most North Americans started trying to understand what that meant instead of simply trying to refute Marx. And so essentially that anything that we hear that's Marxist automatically means that it's evil. Even if we end up in the long run disagreeing, we need to start confronting the reality and learning what it's all about. And I feel quite strongly about that. Again, I don't want you to think that I'm a, you know, I've been called a lot of things, but I'm not a Marxist, but I still accept the value of using Marx in our analysis. Bill, you were going
to
say something?
I was just going to mention people would be surprised if they really studied and saw how much of Marxist beliefs are in our own government.
Absolutely. Yeah. And are biblical. I mean, Marx was not a Christian. That's very clear.
Yeah, he makes it.
But he really does have a concern for the poor and how they're oppressed and exploited. Yes?
Is there a connection between, say, the Protestant churches in Central America and liberation theology, or is it strictly with the Catholics?
No, it's both. It's both. And you have, I guess I didn't make that clear. Historically, it does come out of the Catholic Church. I want to say another thing is that every church in Central America or Latin America is far from being involved in liberation theology. You do have Protestant churches that are very much using those kinds of methods, and you have Catholic churches, and you also have Catholic churches that are not, and you have a lot of very fundamentalist Protestant, Pentecostal, Assembly God. Those kinds of churches are very strong in different parts of Central America, but even within the Assemblies of God, you're going to have some groups, some communities that are theologically going to be what we would consider fairly conservative, and politically be very radical, because they're using a method that's more of a liberation theology. And then you're going to find another Pentecostal group that's going to have no interest whatsoever in politics, because for them everything is after this life and everything is spiritualized. So it runs the whole spectrum, both Protestant and Catholic. Yeah. Were you going to say something?
Well, as far as I know, in Marxism you take away from the people and then you give back according to what they need. That's not what Jesus taught them.
Well, I would disagree with you. I think that's what Jesus probably did taught.
No, don't take anything away. Now, in the case of, Sapphira, what was her husband's name?
Ananias.
Now, if they had given everything and said they gave it all, that would have been great.
Okay, that's not all Marx said. That's what I want to...
It was because they lied that they had given it all. That was why they got into trouble.
All right, let me try to make a distinction between social analysis of Marx and Marx's eschatology, would be the word that a philosopher would use. Marx's social analysis would be essentially saying, this is what's happening, not what should happen. Okay, his eschatology would be, this is what should happen. All right? This is the way the world should be, and this is what we have to do to get there. Okay? Now that is different from Marx in sitting down and saying, when I study the factories in Germany and see how the people work, and I see alienation of the workers because they no longer are really feel any kind of connection with their products, and he goes into a lot of very specific economic analysis of how people are oppressed by wages and that sort of thing. That's the difference, in other words. You see what I mean? In other words, I think he's very helpful in helping us understand what really is happening. a liberation theologian or these people in Central America would use that to try to understand what is happening. They would use the Bible more than to try to say what should happen and how we should do it. They use the Bible actually for both. But that's the distinction I'm trying to make. Does that make any sense? In other words, it would not mean that these people would take everything that Marx says about what we should do and what the world should be. It means saying, as you can read anybody, you can gain insights from anybody without necessarily accepting everything they say is true. Nobody knows the whole truth. And, yeah.
Would this be a way of trying to put it in very, very simple terms then, as I hear you describing, that Marx has some good insights into a diagnosis of the situation?
That's good, yes.
But his choice of treatment is flawed.
I think that, yeah, that's very helpful. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Do you want to teach the rest of this? Phil.
Could I ask you a question? In your experience in Central America, what did you find in the workings and the relationship between the denominations and the churches?
Again, that varied. That I met with.
Generally,
okay. I met with very conservative Catholic bishops, as well as bishops or priests involved in the government in Nicaragua, as well as parish priests out in the country, as well as Protestant clergy work in the country. And the relation, again, it really varies. The relationship in the town that I spent the most time between the Protestant and the Catholic there were very good. And there was a sense of really working together. Am I answering your question? Or?
Yeah, so I'm curious because my experience in the Philippines and working on the floor there in the remote rural areas is there's a tremendous cooperation now that's
right.
developing between the Catholic and the Protestant churches
right.
and different groups, which is wonderful to see.
Yeah. Right.
We haven't had it in a few decades ago.
Right. Yeah, I think that's generally the case, but again, it's not always at all. There's even a split within the Protestant community now. What used to be sort of a council of churches, so to speak, in Nicaragua has now split between a much more conservative element and a more progressive element. I knew I would never get through all this. Last time I did this, we did have an hour and 15 minutes, and I was trying to trim it down, but let me at least get through the basic points. I do think it's really important that we talk about Marx. I do not think you can talk about third world movements without talking about that some. I guess just to allay some of the fears, let me just read a quote from a Chilean Jesuit priest who responded to a North American who was saying, well, and reflecting on what we as North Americans have learned, Robert McAfee Brown was saying, well, that he had learned that we need to listen much more carefully both to the Bible and to Marx. And the Chilean priest, who was very involved in a group called Christians for Socialism, said, why do you put Marx and the Bible right up there together? We don't equate them that way. For us, the Bible provides us with our overall approach to life, while Marx is simply a useful analytical tool within the biblical framework. It's the diagnosis. It's all right to talk about Marx if you want to, but put him in the second paragraph. And I think that's generally the way that most people in Latin America and the Christian communities would approach it. Some people would put Marx further up in the first paragraph, but I think it's fair to say that for almost all of them, the Bible still holds precedent. And again, I think we have a lot to learn from people who can take insights from Marx without losing sight of the Bible. Okay, let me move on. Maybe we could hold our questions for the next 5-10 minutes, and I'll then we can have at least a little bit at the end. There is a heavy emphasis on scripture, on Bible. I think I will skip some of the ways in which interpretation of the Bible is important, but just primarily to say that one of the things that liberation theology teaches us is that we have to always pay attention to where we're standing when we read the Bible. In other words, it is not true that you can just simply say when you read the Bible that the truth is self-evident. That our perspective on the world, whether we're North American and wealthy or poor and live in El Salvador, makes a difference in how we read Scripture. And it means that when we read Scripture, we've got to take into account our own history, the historical context of the Bible itself. We have to take into account how other people see our history, and we have to try to listen to other people's own history, like the poor. I think that's basically a real quick summary, but just to say we can't just read the Bible as though it's self-evidently true. We have always got to look at it in terms of where we stand. Well, if you come to a point of using the social tools and you use the Bible, basically the analysis of liberation theology would be is that the reality of the world is a world of conflict between the oppressed and the oppressor, that there is a struggle going on between different classes of people, and that we as Christians have to be like God, and that not that we are God, but that we have to take sides. That God is not impartial, that God takes sides, that to support the status quo is essentially to support oppression, that we cannot, again, be neutral. That the Bible tells us to love our enemies, it doesn't say to have no enemies. That would be one of the things directly out of Scripture that liberation theology would talk about, that I'm skipping through here, that's why I'm hesitating. That to take sides is to fight oppression, but to liberate, to fight oppression is to both liberate the oppressed and the oppressor. Everyone in the end is going to be better off in terms of real meaning in their lives, and that's an act of love. That to confront things and to fight oppression is an act of love. And that, again, we're not called as Christians to just sort of try to smooth everything out. We are really called to confront oppression. Let me just, I'll skip a couple of the quotes, but let me read. I think this is important. This is by Robert McAfee Brown, who is a I was in Nicaragua with, but he's a retired theologian. And this is one example of how the themes in liberation theology out of the Bible are heavily focused on the Exodus story of Moses leading the people out of Israel is a very key part of the Bible. So let me just read a little quick thing here on how liberation theology would interpret that passage. The story of the Exodus that describes a very partisan God who takes sides with a vengeance. If it were only an isolated passage, we could dispose of it, but it has set its stamp on the whole Bible and has become a paradigm passage for third world Christians living in situations of oppression and injustice similar to the Egyptian situation. To fail to take it seriously is to fail to take the Bible seriously. In the story of Exodus and throughout the whole Bible, the main outlines of the story are clear. One, a class struggle is going on. Two, God is aware of the struggle. Three, God takes sides in the struggle. And four, God calls people to join in the struggle. We start with the people. And what is happening to the people? Clearly, a class struggle is going on. It would be easy for us to digest that claim if only the word class were omitted. Who could disagree that a struggle is going on? But the term class struggle has been used deliberately. In the modern world, Christians need to do more than bristle when they hear the words class struggle. For although Karl Marx may have invented the term, he didn't invent the reality. He merely noticed it and called it to the attention of others. There are two classes of people involved in the book of Exodus, and they are locked in struggle. To reject the term is to reject the story. It's a pretty uneven struggle. The Israelites are slaves, the king and his crowd are slave owners. Here there is a classic oppressor-oppressed situation, complete with intimidation, humiliation, forced labor, powerlessness, and genocide. What happens in such situations is that the oppressed internalize the oppression. They accept their lowly status as appropriate or inevitable, and believing themselves powerless to produce change, they lose hope. Their spirit is broken. God is aware of the struggle. Things have gotten so bad that the Israelites cry out to God. One of my favorite passages in Exodus is, and God heard the cry of the people. That's in Exodus 3. Before God goes to Moses and tells Moses what to do, the passage is, God heard the cry of the people. And essentially was moved to action. God is a God of compassion. God is a God who cries with us. They need help, and the good news is that God is not exclusively wrapped up in contemplation of divine attributes, but is aware of the Israelites' plight. God realizes that certain covenantal agreements already referred to make it necessary for something to happen. God does not side with the powerful. God promises political liberation from the economic and social bondage Israel has endured. God believes that religion and politics mix. For the God who just said, I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, follows up by saying to Moses, come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring forth my people. God calls people to join in the struggle. God, while intervening on behalf of the weak, is quite prepared to use the weak. Moses, for example, is as weak as they come. He ducks and weaves in every possible way to avoid the body blow of an assignment, piling up excuses ranging from the fact that he doesn't know God's name to the fact that he stutters and would therefore be a singularly ineffective negotiator with Pharaoh. If you go back and read Exodus 3 and 4, he does. It's really almost humorous to read all of Moses' excuses, but we don't usually read that part. Another example of God's enlisting the people in their own struggle occurs among the Israelites when Pharaoh instructs the Hebrew midwives to kill the sons of any Hebrew women at whose births they are assisting. The real heroes of the liberation are heroines, a fact our male-dominated scripture usually covers up. The midwives ignore the king's instruction. We've seen enough to secure the main lines of the Exodus story. In a situation of oppression, God takes sides with the oppressed to free them from oppression by empowering them to share in the liberation struggle. The rest of the Bible is footnotes. That's one example. Okay. Out of that sense of struggle, then, liberation theology uses a term called praxis, which I've put up here, which is basically the idea that that you have to have both reflection and action, and that you cannot separate the two. That which is not necessarily a particularly new thought, but in a way it's applied, it is. It means that the way we do our thinking, and this also applies. I'll just sort of do the next two together. That theology and philosophy and ways of thinking about the world are not a matter as we often approach it in Western thought, which is to look at the world as a fixed universe, and then we sit up here and try to analyze what's happening and then decide what to do. So it's sort of a one-directional thing. We think, and then we act out of what we think. And liberation theology says that theology both needs to inform what we do, but what we do also has to be reflected on so that we learn from what we do and we learn from those experiences in a way that then our theology also changes. Let me just read one thing here. that it's not a matter of applying timeless truth to a finished universe in order to understand it, but it's both understanding and the world that remain unfinished. Both our understanding of the world and the world itself needs to be seen as unfinished. We need to always see ourselves as co-creators with God in changing the world. And that's our real commitment. That's the first commitment, is to really be committed to being co-creators with God. And it means being committed to helping God bring in the kingdom. And the kingdom does not mean heaven in the up here sense. It means heaven there, and it also means heaven here and now in this world. It means a new heaven and a new earth. That again, religion and faith is not just something that we do to sort of pay our dues on this earth so that we get rewarded later. And unfortunately, that's so often the way we approach it, salvation and everything else. Salvation can be seen in spiritual terms as well as historical terms. And that liberation then is both spiritual and physical. I will just leave some of these are just books I pulled out of the bookstore that you can look at. There are a lot of other things we could talk about in terms of base Christian communities. Let me just say a couple quick words about how I think it what it means for us as North Americans. And then for those of you who'd like to stay, we can read this little thing that'll take about 8 minutes. I think it really does call us as North Americans to really start reading the Bible in a new way, to understand how we see the Bible through our own lenses, and start trying to be open to the possibility that other lenses may actually be more real or give us more insight into what the world is really like. I think it means that we need to think about our own history as a country and as a people, and how we have been both the oppressor in most situations, but how also what are the ways that we can, at least in some ways, identify with the oppressed. I think it calls us to think about how we relate to oppressed people in our own culture, the blacks. One of the books here is a book called God of the Oppressed, which is a book by James Cone, who is a black theologian at Union Theological Seminary. At least he used to be. I assume he's still there. I think, again, it really calls us to really think about how we integrate our faith and action and how we do theology. And that theology needs to become something that is less philosophy and more social analysis. I think we have to be careful to understand that in some ways we are limited in doing liberation theology. And this is the last thing I will say. That liberation theology is a movement of the poor of this world, and we need to see it not as something that we can take for ourselves and sort of almost domesticate, but we really need to be open to being evangelized and converted by the poor. Now, I really wish I had more time to talk about that, but I really think it's a matter of saying, in many ways, the poor have to teach us, the poor have to liberate us. That we are, in some ways, oppressed because we are oppressors. And that the poor, by in their own struggle, can help us see that, help us confront that, and in a way start moving towards a more of a sense of solidarity with the people in this world instead of a division and struggle between people. I think the next time we do this, I'll do two sessions on this. Why don't we, that is, our time is, okay, it's 5 o'clock right now. If people need to leave, I want you to feel free to do that. Anyone who wants to stay around and talk further, I'll be quite happy to stay here, you know, up until dinner. And I do have something here which I think is this is out of a book called The Gospel of Silente Name, which is a 4-volume set of transcripts of Bible studies by poor people in a base Christian community in Nicaragua. And there's one particular passage here, and it's a matter of saying this is how they would look at it. We could read that. So, if you do need to leave, please feel free. I won't feel slighted at all. Let's take a few questions, and then we'll move to this. Yeah.
Is there any chance of, say, you mentioned several things about the Bible being the Bible of the poor and things like that. Is there any chance of, say, like some evening having a discussion or telling us how you see that? Or is that?
Well, this...
You mentioned several things like that, but now you wouldn't know where to go to find out.
Okay, well, the example of the Exodus, that's the reason I read that. That would be one example. This would be another when we read this. I think that will also help.
And I like your example of the Exodus. I read others that come to a completely different...
Well, so
if you were giving both sides of it, it would be interesting.
Well, see, I think that's exactly sort of the point that liberation theology would say, is that we need to read this stuff from, start seeing it from below, so to speak. That somebody who would read this in a very different... I mean, unfortunately, I think as Americans, we need to identify with the Egyptians. I mean, I think that's where we fall in that story. And that's, you know... But let me just finish it. And so that would be reading it one way, but most of the time, we read it from our own perspective. And you're right, we come out with a very different viewpoint.
Or like, I know some of the theologians read it from, say, God's perspective. That it was God that led the Israelis out of Egypt. It wasn't the human flesh. It was God himself.
I think Robert Bagby Brown said the exact same thing. He's saying that God does do that, but that we participate in it.